You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Media commentator Duncan Grieve wrote an opinion piece this week labelling Facebook Live unsafe and untouchable. He says the platform needs serious work after it broadcast the Christchurch mosque attacks to millions of people around the world. Today, 13 days on from the attacks, Facebook has said they will be banning white nationalism on their platform, but is it a little bit too late? I asked Duncan if he believes Facebook will really eradicate white supremacy from their network.
I take them at their word, despite the fact they have a bit of a history of making statements that are, you know, not necessarily backed up by action. But, you know, Facebook is an enormous and incredibly complex organisation. So in some ways you can understand why it takes some time to process things. And sometimes it does take an awful event to galvanise action in a very big and complex organisation. I think it would, in some ways, having something to point to and say this is a red line for us and that is why, is quite useful. But yeah, the critical thing will be not just the announcing of it, but the continual policing of it, because the lines with this kind of stuff is often quite grey. And you know, the scary thing is they move into the sort of private era of Facebook, where they can see all the data, but they don't necessarily have the right to act on it. So how it collides with that is another question entirely.
Right. And assuming that they do hopefully follow through on what they've said, it's taken 13 days to get to this point. Is that longer than it should have been?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the fact that within a couple of hours, Spark and Vodafone and Vocus were just turning off sites, not worrying about what the sort of free speech or freedom of the internet implications were. They just knew that the situation demanded it. The fact that staff kind of radically altered their comments policy within 10 days. Yes, they're a complex organisation, Facebook are, but they're also a far better resource one than any of those local versions. And they should have viewed this as a crisis that demanded attention on it until it was solved. And it just felt like it was another sort of business issue that needed dealing with. I think that delay sort of spoke to that.
You've written an article where you've talked about Facebook Live and you've said it's unsafe but also untouchable. What does that mean?
Well, I think Facebook Live, at least until, you know, you have major developments in algorithms, and even then I'm not sure. But I think Facebook Live is inherently unsafe, you know. And I don't think we've just sort of allowed it to happen. The fact that anyone around you can instantly start broadcasting you live on the internet is just a massive thing. And the fact that some sites and platforms will allow it isn't an excuse for Facebook, the biggest platform on earth, to say that because it can be done anywhere, then we must do it. I don't think that is actually a logical inference. And it's also not to say that Facebook Live hasn't, you know, in the kind of Black Lives Matter era, had done some real good too, I mean, in a tragic forum, but it's been able to expose things that people don't want to expose. But the sort of sum total of its implications to being kind of weaponized for evil is, you know, it's undeniably there. And, you know, it is striking to me that it's this product that even, I was talking to Val Pomare, who, you know, big time user of Instagram and Facebook's video, who just has always hated those products and never seen them used well or creatively. And I think it's telling that someone who's a big part of that kind of social video community doesn't value it. Like, it's not an important product, even for people who are strong users of that suite of products, yet they just won't turn it off because their whole mentality is, you know, the product must live while we work on making it safer, rather than we will continue to work on it until it's safe.
And imagine, I mean, if that mentality was applied to pretty much anything else, there'd be a lot of outrage.
But this is the thing. I mean, I said this on Radio New Zealand earlier in the week, but you look at the response to Lime scooters. You know, when there was an issue with their brakes locking up, they were taken off the road within 3 days, and within 12 days they were returned fixed. You just, you know, with the Boeing 737s, you know, like there was an issue, the planes were grounded, it was, you know, there's been immense scrutiny of it. I think people just have this misapprehension that because it's software, because it's digital, because it sort of mainly exists on servers like thousands of miles away, that it's not a product and that it can't be touched. And that's just like a misfiling and to a large extent like a political naivety problem. But they're absolutely the same thing. They could have brought down elements of that product and just kept them offline until they were fixed. They just choose not to, and largely they choose not to because we don't exert enough pressure on them.
Mm. And how do you think we do go about exerting pressure? Is it politicians or is it the public?
I think it's everyone all the time. I think the pressure that they're most susceptible to is if there was a real major advertiser boycott. That's what convinced YouTube to disable comments on some of their videos earlier this year. I think politicians have largely been unsuccessful with exerting pressure on them to this point, but basically because they've brought them in for a chat, albeit a quite scary chat, they haven't, for the most part, sort of threatened really serious regulation. The only place where that really is happening is Europe, which has been comfortable with fining and regulating, particularly in Germany, hate speech and so on. And I think Europe is the model for how to properly grapple with these giants. And in the US, it's kind of hopelessly messed up because they also are a big part of the economy there, and they are viewed as a sort of a big part of their expansionary trade ideal. So, you know, it's hard to generate political capital out of it, but Elizabeth Warren has basically advocated for a breakup of them. And I think, personally, that at some stage that is near inevitable, that they are broken down into pieces so that they aren't both the wholesaler and the retailer, you know, and they don't control and that the data to the same kind of terrifying extent.
Assuming that Facebook did actually take down its live platform, how do you even make it safer? It's live video. I mean, do people have to just constantly be watching every single video that goes live, or is there another way to prevent things from being broadcast?
I think that there is I don't think that it's a human intervention. I just, you know, Facebook would have to become the world's biggest employer by far, and it couldn't justify that. I do think that it will require more human intervention, but ultimately they'll need to figure out a way through machine learning and AI to distinguish real violence, gore, gunshots, explosives from the sort of largely photorealistic video game representations, which are actually a huge part of the streaming economy. It's going to be immensely difficult.
I think that's the challenge, isn't it?
And yet, for it to be safe, they must do it. I don't think it's unimaginable that in a year's time, live streaming is basically something that on Facebook and YouTube is reserved for a tiny fragment of their creators, that it's not, that it's, there is an increasing understanding that it shouldn't be for everyone. May well be that there's another platform springs up, and that's where it is a bit more of a Wild West situation, and that has a lot more live streaming. But, you know, that we as a species realise that we shouldn't have opened that door so wide, and thus we try and get it a bit, you know, close to just a crack, because just because you can do something doesn't mean that you have to. And, you know, as humans, we have shown an ability to kind of recognize that and evolve past it. And I think maybe that just shrugging and accepting that, well, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, I don't know if that's true.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you about stuff.co.nz changing the rules around their commenting and selecting what topics are and are not allowed to have comments. Is that overdue?
Probably. Yeah. I think that for a long time, and actually despite their, if not their best efforts, and certainly decent efforts, the comment sections have been a pretty rough place, especially for women and people of colour and other sort of minorities. It is difficult because that is a big part of their culture and part of how they sort of how stuff expresses its value to advertisers. That has this very engaged base, but that base is also can be incredibly toxic. What I really like about what they've done is said that you can debate